Well, good afternoon to all you here. We're halfway through the feast, or have we gone down? Where are we gone? Yeah, the halfway mark's gone. We're all downhill now. What I think I'd like to do today is continue on from where I finished off the other day, but go on to the teaching side, the positive side. What are we actually going to be teaching people? Now, obviously, we've got the Bible. I mean, that's the main sort of source. But also, Mr. Armstrong wrote an awful lot of material which is more lined up with the way people think today. But it's also timeless. Now, what I'd like to do today, I'll give you one example to start off with anyway. We'll look at the seven laws of success. Because we're going to have to teach this. Now, we should be living it now. Because if we're living it now, we can then show people in the future the benefits, can't we? So first of all, we start off, we've got to teach people to have a right goal. So here we are today, our right goal, obviously, is to qualify, to make it into the kingdom of God as part of the first fruits. But these people will be at the receiving end of the first fruits. We'll be there teaching them. But what are we going to be telling them? We're going to be pointing out to them that they are going to become like us. If they grow and get themselves sorted and prove to themselves that God's way is the only way that works. Now remember, these people are going to inherit a mess. And we keep on going over this, but it's good we get it firmly into our heads. Because when I first came into the church, it was cool. You see, Christ was going to come down, zap, mountain bursts in two, river gushes out to both sides, the remnant is all quickly gathered in, and start building houses, and away we go. It's all sorted and cut and dried. The weather's great. We start spreading all over the globe. You know, we've matured a little now. We've sat and we've thought about it. We've read the scriptures again. And it's not quite like that, is it? When those people come back into the land is going to be desolate. It's going to be as desolate as it ever has been. Really. It seems the continents are going to move. The mountain ranges will have disappeared. You can't even imagine what this can do. You see you've got Anna here who witnessed a decent-sized earthquake down in Chile. And she described the other day to us the devastation. And that was a mere, I think that one was pushing 9 on the Richter scale, I think. Yeah. Yeah, it was pushing 9 on the Richter scale, which is pretty heavy. This is back in the early 1960s. And huge chunks of the coast just literally disappeared into the sea. And she was telling us that some of the fishermen, the people live on shellfish a lot, and the sea just disappeared. So, hey, they're all in there, thousands of them. They didn't realize that the sea was actually just building up to come back. And they don't know how many people died in the tsunami. You know, that's a small thing. That's nothing. Absolutely nothing. What happens when that mountain burning with fire slams into the ocean? Destroys a third of the sea. What kind of tsunami are we going to see from that? That final earthquake shakes every city, destroys every single city on the planet. If there's much left to destroy by that time. So these people are going to inherit this. And they're going to have to realize that they're going to have to work. And we had, I think it was Mr. Monroe was mentioning about sleep, wasn't it, earlier on? They're going to sleep well. Because they're going to work jolly hard. They'll be starting on the first day of the week, and they'll be ending on the sixth day of the week. And I'll tell you what, they're going to appreciate the Sabbath. They really are going to appreciate the Sabbath. But we're going to have to give them the goal. We're going to have to do a selling job on them, frankly. Because all they're going to see is this utter devastation. They've just been through 3.5 years of the worst time that's ever existed on the planet. Right? Their mind is going to be addled completely. You're literally going to have to take these people by the hand and gently lead them. So what do? You show them the goal. Right? They're looking at you, and there you are standing in front of them. They know who you are. They've already been told. They realize they're being taught by the God family. And we tell them, your goal is to be sitting up here and in the same state that I am. Your goal is to be immortal. And that's, you think of, you're offering them this on the one hand, and they're looking forward to a 7-month cleanup, which is going to be a mountainous job. Work it out. 160 million skeletons, bodies and bits and pieces have got to be cleaned up in 7 months. Work it out. Take the Sabbaths out and work out how many days there are. And I think you'll find that they're going to be clearing up, I think it was over 500,000 bodies a day. So they're going to be using all the vehicles and stuff that's been left by this army. So they've all got to be trapped up to a valley and dumped. And all the time we're telling them, this is what you're doing. You're preparing the earth so that all these people that have ever lived can come up in a resurrection. All your family, going way back, you'll be able to see all of them. But here you are now. You are the pioneers. There's something nice about being in this sort of pioneer group. When I went to Brickett Wood in 64, a lot of the buildings weren't there. There was no gymnasium. The men's dormitory had just opened. The girls' dormitory was a dream. The girls were all stuck in Memorial Hall in various little rooms and all over the place. It was like a rabbit warren up there. And a lot of the gardens weren't the way they were eventually. But to be in there and to be part of that building, we actually built lakes. We actually excavated the ground. And then we got down to, we thought it was clay and it was gravel. So we had to put the liners on. And then we had to put a thick layer of clay on top of the liner. But the lakes are still there. The lakes are still there. It's exciting to be in on the ground floor when you're doing something. And that's what these people are going to be. And that's what we've got to stress to them. You're here today, and look at the future that you're building. Look at the future you're building, and you're going to see all your family, all those people you lost in the tribulation, all the ones that died before then. You're going to see them all come back. And you are going to have to teach them. Right? So 6 days a week, your job is to get this earth to where it is a paradise. Literally, the Garden of Eden. But on the weekends, on the Sabbath, you're going to be learning spiritually how eventually you can qualify to enter the God family. Now, that's some goal. That's some goal. And that's what we've got to teach them. Tomorrow, the goal will be immortality as a truly born-again, immortal spirit being in the family of God. I don't think that's going to be too difficult. You're the living proof, aren't you? You're standing in front of them. You are the living proof. It's not like today. We see nothing. I'll be going through that in a few minutes. We have nothing we can actually see. Or we have the word, and we've seen the actions, we've seen things happen. But these people will literally walk and talk with God, with the God family. So their job's going to be a lot easier. The second of the seven laws was teaching the right education, the right educational system. So we don't need to give any more. We can just talk for the rest of the afternoon on this, can't we? The educational system today. They will have to learn to be successful. You know, the people in the world today don't know what success is. You know what success is? Success is achieving goals. It doesn't matter what the goal is. You know, if you've got to be out of bed and dressed and here for services at 10 o'clock in the morning and you make it, some people I notice sneak in at 1:02, mind you. He's up there. We won't point any fingers. But you've achieved your goal, haven't you? You've achieved your goal. And you save all your second tithe up over the year, and you come to the feast, you've got that extra money to spend, you've achieved your goal. That is success. These people, Warren Buffett, George Soros, the Rothschilds and all that lot, they're not happy people. In fact, right now, a lot of them are very worried people. Yeah. If the banks close tomorrow and I lose all my money in the bank, no big deal. But 1.5 months survival money, gone, that's it. Mr. Soros would lose 600 billion or thereabouts. That's the petty cash. People like Rothschilds will not tell you. You've no way of working out what they're worth, but it runs into trillions, trillions, literally. They're the ones that don't sleep. Money's not success. I know Mr. Armstrong used to quote J. Paul Getty. who was one of the big wheels back in the 30s and 40s. And he said he'd give away his whole fortune for one successful marriage. So, what is value? What is it? We've got to teach these people what it is. Every one of these people will have to be freed from the shackles of pagan teaching, tradition, erroneous knowledge, the false sense of values, pagan customs, and it will take generations. Mr. Armstrong made a comment. He says, these minds, and they are indeed the world's finest and best minds, have become so perverted with false education that they will be unable to accept truth until they first unlearn error. Do you want to sit down with Mr. Hawking and explain to him how, why, and when the universe began? Or just call in Jesus Christ and say, this is the man that said, it all came from nothing. Would you like to explain to him the workings of the Holy Spirit? Yeah, I think he would suddenly feel very small. In fact, he'd probably wish that the floor would open up under his feet. But you know, we're not there to be little, because these people are all deceived. We're there to build up. And I'm sure that he, when he finally realizes just what has been involved, that he will be quite an interesting person. In a co-worker letter, December 16, 1984, Mr. Armstrong said, even after Christ comes to remove Satan and to bring in peace, prosperity, and happiness, the process will have to begin with children. I hope you children are listening, because you're going to be the examples to which other children will look. Because your mom and dad will be God. Think about it. Think about it when somebody tries to beat you up, and you say, my daddy is bigger than your daddy. Children will have to be started off right from the beginning. Adults will have to be de-educated, he said. Have to unlearn all the false knowledge, the ideas, the philosophies they have before they can be taught the true way towards peace and successful and happy, useful lives. Is that not the key? Happy, useful lives. Yes, I retired some time ago. And we joke about it because I actually work more now than I've ever worked in my life. But I feel I'm doing something useful. And it's not that difficult to get out of bed in the morning when you've got a list of things to do this long and you know it's important and you've got to you feel you're doing something, you're achieving something. And that's what it's all about. If you haven't got anything to achieve, you live on a farm, you're into a cycle. They have Adele there with her goats. She's got to get the ram in there at the right time because she knows how long it takes for those little goats to mature and to be born. And she wants them born at a certain time because she knows what the weather's like. And it's a yearly cycle. You're going all the way through the year. And you've got cows, you've got chickens, you've got all the rest of it. It's all little goals. It's planning. It's achieving. There's nothing nicer than looking over a field of animals grazing away there. You can drive around here. I don't know how many sheep there are in Wales, but I'll tell you what, there's got to be more sheep than people. There must be millions of the things. They're everywhere. But these people will have happy lives and they'll be achieving things because they'll have a goal. And the goal's impossible, isn't it? Landscape the whole world. Bring all nations into the fold so they can be directed by Christ. But they'll know it's not impossible because they'll see, starting with Egypt and Libya and some of the nations across there, they'll gradually go and go. And eventually, the other nations will just see it. Hey, we want some of this. Because don't forget, they're going to have nothing. They're going to be back in the Stone Age. Right? No electricity. You know, take the electricity away and we're back in caves, aren't we? We're back in caves. We're rubbing two rocks together to get a spark, to get a fire. Think about it. It's that bad. They'll never recover. They'll only recover with our help. So it's not just our people that we're sorting out, it's the rest of the world as well. He says, utopia will not appear suddenly at the appearing of Christ. It's going to take a lot of hard work. In a sermon, he gave it in 1983, Trunk of the Tree. It's going to take about three generations before, and then he stopped and he said, maybe four generations. We find that we have taken away all the false teachings of the Protestant churches and the Roman Catholic Church and the other ideas and traditions of humans and taught them the truth of God. It's going to take generations before they come to really understand it. Like I said the other day, we've got to start training them with something as basic as the days of the week, the months of the year. A whole new financial system. Oh boy. No more banks, no more bonds, no more derivatives, no more stock market. No more people making millions one day and losing billions the next. If you notice, by the way, in the news, just keep your eye on the stock market, because the Dow Jones is going downhill like a brick. It's way under 16, they're down in the 16,000s now, I think about 16 and a half. It was way over 17 and a half just a few weeks back. They're panicking, because little things. Our society is so pernickety. A few people die of Ebola, and I'm not running putting Ebola down. All right, there's 4,000 people died of Ebola, and it's a horrible disease. But over 1,000 people died in this country this year simply falling down the stairs. So how important is Ebola? Well, it is. It's nasty. But the stairs, you know, they're dangerous as well. But nobody talks about falling down the stairs. How many thousands of people have died on the roads in accidents? Which is, you know, more than not carelessness. You see, we get everything jumbled up. All our values are totally confused. They're going to have to learn the true meaning of the word love. Because today, the minute you mention love, people's minds shoot off down a dirt track. I noticed the other day now that they've brought out a new book for our teenagers in school. Everything you wanted to know about sex, with pictures. Now, some people are criticizing it and saying it's a little pornographic. Of course it's pornographic. But this is what they're giving our teenagers. What they're saying is, it's okay. Just this is how you do it. You know, this is the. Instead of pointing out to them that this was the sort of cherry on the cake in a marriage, to bond two people together, to form a family, which we'll go into in a minute. The key factor of the way God works is families. He's a family. He's going to be a family. He's enlarging his family right now. We're part of it. And look what man's done to it. They're teaching little five-year-old children that, you know, it's okay if there's two daddies. This boy's got two daddies or he's got two mummies. We've had that in the church. We know people who've actually said that. Little girls said, oh, they've got two mummies across the road there. Vile. That's what God calls it. It's beyond. I can't think of a nastier word that I can say without getting into trouble. It is vile. It's really vile. Psalm 119, 172, we all know it. My tongue shall speak of your word, for all your commandments are righteousness. You know, this truth of God is so complicated, isn't it? Love God, love your neighbor as yourself. Boom, next question. That's it. That's the whole law of God. Now, obviously, it goes out and out and out. And you've got to apply it the right way, but that's what it's all about. Showing love towards God and love towards your neighbor. Loving your neighbor as yourself. Today, if you start a conversation by discussing God and his way of life, you won't get much of an audience. You will be branded as a religious nutcase. And with the God family there in person, and God's spirit poured out on all flesh, Joel 2:28, interaction with God will be normal. It will be an everyday event. Can you try and think of a world like that? But you know, it's like that for us, isn't it? We pray every day, don't we? We are interacting with God every day. Jesus Christ and God the Father are with his people wherever we gather. They're here now. That's why when people get up here to speak, we've got to be careful what we say. The boss is listening. And we're told what to teach. And anybody who's ever prepared a sermon will understand that, because you prepare your notes, and then you pray about it, and you prepare your notes, and you leave it for a few hours, and you go back and you think, no, that's different. My wife always says to me, why do you prepare before? Because you always change it the day before anyway. Some things have become everyday topics. When I went to college, I had a few days before classes started. We started classes, I think, a week before the actual feast. And I took a girl down to London on a date, a Canadian girl. And we were numb. I mean, she'd come from Canada. which in those days was the backwoods. I had come from South Africa, which frankly, when it comes to this world, was Stone Age. They were still living in the 1930s. It was such a rigid society. And we arrived, we got down into the underground, and we were going to get up and said, let's get the lift. So we got into the lift, and as we got in, this thing came in behind us and stood with its back towards us. But it kind of like had a blue suit on, and it looked like a mannish suit. Oh, but the hair. This girl dug me in the ribs. She said, I'd kill for hair like that. And it was beautiful halfway down the back. And then he turned around and had a beard. Here's the fella. But that was the norm in London. We weren't used to that. Now, when I was working in the photographic area with news, we weren't allowed to show photographs of a dead body. You couldn't even allude to it anywhere in the press, not just college, not just the plain truth. It wasn't done back in the 60s. You just didn't do it. Today, anything goes. Here's an example. Incest. Yeah? Incest. In 1964, the word homosexuality was regarded as a swear word. You didn't say it, right? Incest was beyond that. Listen to this. This is the world, this is the kind of people, we're going to have to educate people out of this slop. Listen to this. Although there have been common throughout history prohibitions against incest, which is sexual relations between blood relatives, have become increasingly difficult to understand and defend. Right? There you see. Just off the side, and now we're going off track. In part, this is a result of a misunderstanding. Ah, you see, the old school was wrong. We often think that the primary reason to ban incest is to prevent genetic abnormalities or other harm to children who might be conceived. You better believe it. You better believe it. You want to look at our royal family. All is it haemophilia? The bleeding job there, the blood doesn't coagulate and so on. This is the kind of problem that comes through. When there are so many options available by which to prevent such harm, this reasoning seems less than intelligent. Incestuous couples could simply refrain from having children, for example, or use assisted reproduction technology to conceive healthy ones. You can sin all you like because we'll help you get around the penalty. You know, yet again, medical science will save us. Medical science that has somewhat mixed ethics. You remember some time ago, there was a case where you have a hospital, and this is genuine, it happened, two operating theatres next door to each other. In the one, a surgeon is cutting a baby out of the womb. Sorry, people, but that's what they do. Yeah? In the next operating theatre, there's another surgeon fighting like mad to save a little baby's life. Same age. Ethics? Go on. Can't believe there's any ethics in medicine. God's instructions are very, very clear. Now, I'm going to read from Leviticus 18. This is the kind of stuff we've got to teach. Because people are like this. People are warped. People are twisted. They're coming out of this society where Satan has twisted minds. Leviticus 18, 1-4. Now, in the King James, the term uncovered their nakedness. You see, back then they couldn't say it, could they? They couldn't bring themselves to say it. So I'm going to read this in a modern translation. Verse 1, Leviticus 18. Then the Eternal said to Moses, give the following instructions to the people of Israel. I am the Lord your God. Now, that's the key factor, isn't it? I am the boss. The buck stops on my desk. There is nobody else. Yes, I designed the whole thing. So do not act like the people in Egypt where you used to live, or like the people of Canaan where I'm taking you. You must not imitate their way of life. You must never have sexual relations with a close relative. Why? Because I am the Eternal. In other words, this is not a suggestion, people. This is from your Maker. And it said in verse 22, if you drop down to verse 22, again, it's plain English now. Do not practice homosexuality, having sex with another man as with a woman. It is a detestable sin. You see, people are going to have to be taught a whole new set of values. That first batch of children that come through into the millennium are going to be perverted with all this garbage they're filling them with now, aren't they? We're going to have to work hard on those children to straighten minds out, to put something else in there, something wholesome. They will become skilled in applying eventually the principles of God's commandments, laws, statutes, judgments, and they will see the benefits. When you get married and the girl is a virgin, and so are you. That's something intimate. You've never shared that with anybody else. Doesn't happen very often today. And the basic law, as I said earlier on, the basic law is so simple. In Mark 12:30, just make a note of it. It just mentioned there when Christ was asked, he said, you will love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength. You will love God totally, absolutely, utterly. Why? Because he's given you life and he's going to give you eternal life in his family. What else can he give you? Yeah? And the second is like this, namely, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. There is no other commandment greater than these. That's amazing. I remember once one of the ministers saying, you know, God is so complicated, you can write his law, his whole law, on the back of a cigarette packet. I thought to myself, I hope you're not smoking. How about the Ten Commandments? Now, you know, they've said this is done away with. Why? Why do they say the Ten Commandments are done away with? Well, quite frankly, they more or less keep the nine. Well, they don't understand the first four. They don't understand the love towards God. But the last six people keep, pretty much. I won't bother with the first four. Mr. Bowles covered that yesterday. But one of the problems, especially with the second commandment, people today, because they're physical in their religion. You've got to wear a crucifix. You've got to have something that reminds you of. The Catholics have their rosary, a bunch of beads, and they go charging around these, uttering the same old prayer, frantically. Uttering a prayer to who? Saint Peter. Well, first of all, it's not the Saint Peter. And secondly, if it is a Peter, which it is, he's well dead and gone. There's not a scrap of him remaining anywhere. They need a physical reminder. We worship God in the spirit and in truth. We don't need a physical reminder because we've got God's spirit in us. So our thinking is getting along the lines. We're starting gradually to think more like God does. And it's not easy. Don't take God's name in vain. If you've ever been in a church, I went to take photographs in a big church one time. And they all stand up and say, Our Father which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come, thy will be done. That's what it sounds like. Rubba, 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 rubba. Amen. And they all sit down. And then a guy with a frock gets up and he gives a sermon, which is the reading for today, children, is. I'm not joking. This is the way this man was talking. You know, your beloved and God's wonderful children. And he read a sort of scripture that didn't mean a thing. And pontificated on it for about 30 seconds and did his little bit, and then off he went piously walking down the centre with all the little boys behind them with the bells and the smells and all the rest of it. That's religion. That's what they think. That's how they're worshipping their God. Now, I mean, it's easy for us to mock it, but they're so deceived. They don't understand. But we got to work with people like this. We have to straighten them out. Taking God's name in vain today is the norm. How many times have you heard people, And with respect, Christ has got nothing to do with the fact you just smashed your thumb with a hammer. Yeah. It's your fault. So why are you blaming him? And so it goes on. Now, the key factor is Exodus 20, verse 8. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days shall you labor and do your work, but on the seventh day is a Sabbath of the eternal your God, and you shall not do any work, you, nor your son, nor your daughter, nor your manservant, nor your maidservant, nor your cattle, nor the stranger that's within your gates. Nobody works. Get the point. Why? Because it's a day where you link in to God. One of the things on the Sabbath that comes out is we should be looking to the creation. Nothing like on the Sabbath if you can just take a little walk outside. Now, if you're living in the centre of London, that's a bit difficult. I'm talking with trees and flowers and parks and animals. And this is what God made. God did not make concrete skyscrapers, filthy diesel buses, and all the other paraphernalia of a city. Yeah? But God blessed the Sabbath day. He hallowed it. But we don't today in the world, do we? We do. We do, because our minds have been opened. But, you know, you look at the world today, even in Israel, by the way, there was a bunch of people who wanted to let people trade on the Sabbath. And there's a furore going on down there now. Because a certain part of Israel, the people are becoming more religious, but they're not really religious, but they realize that there's something there that they can't put the finger on. Now, you've got the rabbis on the one side who are religious. You get the ultra-Orthodox people, the Temple Institute people. They're going one direction. They went on that Temple Mount. They want to build a temple. They spent millions of dollars on getting everything ready. It's all there. They can start the daily sacrifices tomorrow. All they've got to do is pick up the stones of the altar they've got down the road about 20 kilometers, bring it into Jerusalem, set it up, and away they go. So don't expect it to be years before they start the sacrifices. They can start them, if they can get control of that area or get some agreement to where they can use a certain area for that purpose, those sacrifices could start within 24 hours. The sacrifices could. And remember when they went back at the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, the first thing they did on the Feast of Trumpets, I think it was, they set up the altar, which is just literally rough stones. And they started sacrificing the morning and evening sacrifices, didn't they? And they did that for years before the temple was built. So we don't need a temple necessarily. You see in verse 17, God repeats it again. It is a sign between me and the children of Israel forever. Forever. While there is a human being on the ground, then it's a sign. Now let's look at the last of the commandments. Honor your father and mother. Interesting, there's a blessing there. There's a blessing there, which I'm claiming. Yeah, I'm claiming. My mother-in-law looked after her mother, and she died eventually when she was 95. The last thing she knew was that Philip had been born. We told her, and the next day she went. Sheila's mum died when she was also 90. No, she was 90. Yeah, she was only 18 months off getting a telegram from the Queen. She was 98 and a half. And you know what? Right up until virtually the end, she was completely compos mentis. Amazing. So we're going to claim that blessing, kid. We're not going to be around that long, are we? I hope. Yeah. The whole focus is on the family. After all, they will learn that their future will be in the kingdom of God, immortal, in a family. They will be taught the family structure with the husband at the head of the family, with the wife as his helper. That in the King James, this is a help meet. It means a helper who is just right for him. Yeah, we need a helper. How else am I going to get my collar down at the back? I mean, you know. This is where relationships have gone badly wrong in the world, because we've got the upside down situation where the women wear the pants and then it becomes a disaster. So men tend to be very analytical. Women tend to be very emotional. You put the two together, you can come to a right decision most of the time. But the trouble is, it's not that way anymore. It's not that way anymore. The relationship has broken down, and so is the family unit. There are more people in this country today and in America living together unmarried. Living together as if they were married, but they're not married, than there are people who are married. That's a fact. That's a fact. And they don't stay together either, which is another fact. God takes family very seriously. I wonder if you children know this, if you children are actually listening to this. Exodus 21 verse 15. This shows you how God feels about the relationship in a family. He that smites, he that hits or strikes his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. That was the law under the in the Old Testament. That's what God thinks of a family. Young people were to be taught and trained and brought up and educated, because ultimately they become the next part of the ongoing family, don't they? The family unit is the basis for everything. But of course, Satan has aimed his weapons at the family in no small way. Families are all but destroyed. And yet, you know, all you've got to do is look in the history books and you will see that whenever a nation suffers the breakdown of the family unit, within 100 years, they're history. They're gone. They're finished. Not one survived. The family unit is the bedrock of a solid nation. Exodus 20. Thou shalt not kill. Murder. What a world it would be. Look at our world today. Murders happen on a daily basis. You can't pick up a newspaper, but there's somebody being murdered in the most atrocious way. And of course you can add to that terrorism. That's all just murder. And how about war? How about war? We're commemorating the 100th anniversary of the First World War, aren't we, this year? And I can never understand. I think of, you see those newsreel film. Not, I'm not talking about movies now. With Burt Lancaster and somebody storming over the trenches and winning the war for America or whatever. I'm talking about real flesh and blood people on a movie film. And you see them getting over the top, they blow the whistle, and then over they go, and they run. And all they're carrying is a simple 303 rifle with a big bayonet stuck on the end. And the other bunch at the other side get the machine guns out, and they just go across, and they mow them all down. And then it's quiet for a few minutes. And then on that side, they blow a whistle and their guys get up and they run across and the other guys get the machine guns and they mow them down. And that happened until there were over 1 million people lying dead. Crazy? Where does that come from? Satan. It is the most dumb thing I've ever read in a history book. The dumbest kind of war. It's almost as bad as the early British, when the muzzle loaders came out. The two sides would face each other. I think they'd toss a coin or whatever and see who shot first. You know? And you'd fire, bang, they'd all fall down, and then the remnant would get up and they'd shoot some of you guys until one lot had more surviving than the others. It's a bit more clinical today. You know, you blow them from 50,000 feet or whatever. It's all murder. How many people over the centuries have died in wars? I mean, just in this last 100 years, it's quite incredible. And yet, you know what? There was more people died in the flu epidemic after the war than there was in the war. It's flu, just simple, well, it wasn't simple flu, but it killed millions. In fact, the full death toll is not, it's not possible to even know it. But you know, it goes further than that. It's easy. We get these people and they've just cleaned, They're just clearing all these dead bodies out, right? And they've now got to the Sabbath, and they're sitting in front of you, and you say, right, the one commandment we're going to look at today is, thou shalt not kill. Do you get the point? Killing is not a good idea, because our boss, our King of Kings, Jesus Christ, he's perfect at it. That's what happened. You are cleaning up the mess, right? So killing is not a good idea. No, the law not. Yeah, no, we don't want any more killing. No, no more killing. But you know, that's just the beginning of it, isn't it? You turn to Matthew 5. You see, it's much more than the physical act. Jesus magnified the law. It's not just about the physical act of killing. It's even thinking about it. It's even going further. It's even showing hatred to somebody. In fact, it even goes further than that, as I'll show you. Matthew 5:21. You have heard that it was said by them of old time, of the old school, you see, thou shalt not kill, and whoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. But I say to you, this is Christ now speaking, whosoever is angry with his brother without cause shall be in danger of the judgment, and whoever says to his brother, Raka, and Raka means you're useless, you're worthless, shall be in danger of the council, and whosoever shall say, you fool, shall be in danger of hell fire. Now then, that's a different story, isn't it? You see what I mean? We've got to change people's thinking. We've got to change the whole way they think. Now there'll be a new language. That'll hopefully make things a bit easier. And look at the next commandment. Exodus 20 verse 14. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Oh boy. Today it's a spectator sport. This is one of the main reasons for the breakup of the family unit. You've got two of the Ten Commandments which are focused on the family. Not committing adultery and honoring parents. That's an amazing amount of God's law just centered on the family, isn't it? God takes family relations seriously, and so must we. And so must the people we teach. We have to be living it now so we can teach it tomorrow. Some in the church over the years have had broken relationships. And that's sad, but by the same token, they will know what it's like. I remember when I'd only been in college a few months, and my cousin came down from Scotland, and she was in London, she visited me. Now, I hadn't seen her since she was a scrawny little 16-year-old. She was a bit older than me when I was about 12. When we went down to Africa, she was about 16. But now she was the lady. She had just been divorced. And she arrived on campus in a taxi with a pelmet on. Oh, sorry, I mean a skirt. No, a pelmet. Made up like, oh. And here I'm walking around, showing around the campus, and everybody's looking at you. Is that a new student? No. Do you know what she said to me? I said, oh, I'm sad to hear about your divorce. Ah, she says, divorce never hurt anybody. Remember that statement, because I'll tell you, you talk to anybody who's been divorced, and they'll tell you the hurt. Some of the church were abused as children. They can relate to that. Do you know how many children are abused out there today? They're finding more and more and more. Look at this Jimmy Savile thing, just for starters. And he's only one person. It's vile what's going on out there. But while they've got to be taught this basic law of love, they've also got to be taught their spiritual application of that law. Now, see what I'm saying? We've got to change their whole thinking. That's going to be very difficult. Matthew 5:27, he says, you've heard it said, that it was said by them of old time, thou shalt not commit adultery, but I say to you that whosoever looks on a woman to lust after her has committed adultery with her already in his heart. Now you ladies might not feel too much about this, but from the fellow's point of view, we are bombarded on all sides. You can't pick up a newspaper. You see the billboards. You walk down the street, and you have the woman's body being thrown at you with as little covering as possible. I see the latest thing I noticed on one of the internet things the other day. There was a thing on, what was it, celebrity, what do they call them? Wardrobe malfunctions. Right? Now, see, what they do is to get their name up in the papers, they have a wardrobe malfunction. A strap breaks and certain parts of the body are exposed. And it takes them a while to fumble around because all the cameras are on. And then it's on the news. So-and-so, so-and-so. Oh, look at this. Big deal. It's all focusing on sex. I always remember driving down the road once. There's this billboard with this gorgeous young lady on there. And she had the tiniest bikini on. And do you know what she was advertising? Nuts and bolts. I rest my case. Crazy. Nuts and bolts. Thou shalt not steal. Ooh. No need for locks on the door. No need for a police force. Mr. Hancock will be pleased about that. No need for all the security systems that we have today. I laughed when we first arrived here, and Philip said to me that he just met Alwyn, who just said, there's the keys, grunk, about 2 kilos of them. We don't need any of that anymore. Because, you know, people won't even think. It's like you come in the hall, and there's a Bible left there or something, and you open it up, and you see Mr. Pippi's name on it. Yeah, you know, put it in your case, and wait till he goes back to Canada and see, I've got a new Bible, man. Yeah, run off and take it back to him, don't you? I mean, this is the way people need to be taught how to think. It's not yours, you take it back. I mean, the Bible even says if you see your enemy's ox in the ditch, well, first of all, you shouldn't have an enemy. But you should take that ox out of the ditch and take it back. Because what do you do by doing that? You knock on the door and say, excuse me, yeah, what do you want? I've just pulled your ox out of the ditch, mate. Oh, yeah, ox is probably worth a few $1,000 or whatever. Oh, yeah, oh, come and have a cup of tea or whatever. You see, the enemy's no more an enemy, is he? Why? Because you've shown him love. You've looked after his property. You didn't have to. Except God says you do. You see, we've got to change the whole way. We ourselves are perverted by this world. It's not good. One of the other aspects within the church, of course, is tithing. And when I was reading this, I thought, that's interesting. Matthew 6 verse 19 talks about lay not up for yourself treasures on earth where moth and rust can corrupt and where thieves break through and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust does corrupt and where thieves do not break or steal. There are no thieves in heaven. There will be no thieves in God's family. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. In my 50 years in the church, I have seen much evidence to back up the following scripture. Malachi 3 verse 8. And I'm going to read this in a modern translation because it just cleans up the English. Malachi 3 verse 8. Should people cheat God? Right? Should they cheat God? Yet you have cheated me, but you ask, what do you mean? When did we ever cheat you? God says, you have cheated me of the tithes and the offerings due to me. You are under a curse and your whole nation has been cheating me. Bring all the tithes into the storehouse so there will be enough food in my temple. There's a reason for this. Part of that reason is God is a giving God. Right? He didn't make Adam and leave him in the middle of the Namib desert or whatever. Yeah? He made him outside, but then he put him in that garden in Eden. He put him in perfection. He gave him everything he needed, plus some. You see, God's a giver. And he says, if you do, says the Lord of heaven's armies, I will open the windows of heaven for you. I will pour out a blessing so great you won't have enough room to take it in. Try it. Put me to the test. That's a challenge. It's not a question. You put me to the test. And see the proof. And I know we were looking back at some of our third tithe years. Some of the best blessings we ever had. New job, new car, more money, whatever. But there was always, we always came out the third tithe year thinking, well, what are we worried about? You know, a whole extra tenth of your salary gone. But it works. But further, he says, your crops will be abundant, for I will guard them. I will guard them, God says. I will guard them from insects and disease. Right? I know, Andy, you've got an allotment. How'd you like that? No bugs, no slugs, no snails, no beetles. I grew a crop of potatoes. We got in the first house when we came back from South Africa, and we put a crop of potatoes in. They were great. So I thought the next year I'll do the next bit of the garden and I'll put potatoes in there because they break up the soil and so on. And when we dug them up, they were full of minuscule little slugs. Oh, about half an inch long, but just over a centimetre long. The whole crop gone. And, you know, can you imagine a farmer having 50, 60, 70, 80, 100 acres and finding all the potatoes like that? God says here, your crops will be abundant, for I will guard them from insects and diseases. Your grapes will not fall from the vine before they're ripe. Then all nations will call you blessed, for your land will be such a delight. This is the key, because when the people get to doing this, and their land's a delight, and the people across the border are looking and thinking, I'll have some of that. We want that way. I went down to Israel just after the Six-Day War. It was actually 1970. And our taxi driver was very keen to show us the fact that when you drive up towards Jerusalem, you're driving through orange groves. Rows upon rows of oranges on this side, and on this side there was other stuff. All they covered the side of the hill with black polythene, and they put little holes in, and they put plants in. And at night time, they run the water down, and the water only goes in where the plants are, and it's gathered at the bottom, and during the day it's pumped back up, and at night time, that's how they irrigate. And particularly strawberries, and you'll see that there, and they put them straight in the pallets, and straight down to the airport, and they're in London the next morning. They're fresher than stuff grown out in the countryside here. That's what the Jews are like. They're hot when it comes to producing. And you'll come round a corner, and there's a pile of rubble here, and a pile of rubble there, and a bit of barbed wire, and then rocks and sands. Rocks and sand. More rocks and sand. That's the Arab Quarter. And you drive for a few miles, and then you come to another barricade that's been torn off, and the road, suddenly the road gets nicer again, and you're back into Orange George. You're back into the Israeli side. It's incredible. Absolutely incredible. How God has blessed those people. But they work jolly hard, you see. This is the thing. But that's what these people, looking from the disaster that's the rest of the world, looking into Israel, and after a few years, they see the fields and the crops and the orchards all growing up and so on. And they'll look at that and think, well, why haven't we got that? That's when they'll come. And they'll have to be then, again, taught. We'll be teaching those people as well. We'll be teaching those people as well. But they need to learn the principle that where your treasure is, you see, where your treasure is. And if your treasure is making money, then I've got news for you. The way things are going, you're not going to have it much longer. Because the banking system is right on the brink of collapse. It cannot go on. Everybody's saying this. They're just waiting to see who's brave enough to pull the plug. So, we'll see. Thou shalt not bear false witness against your neighbor. That's Exodus 20, verse 16. People will be taught to tell the truth. All the time. All the time. And thou shalt not covet. There's another one, you know. Guy drove into church in a brand new car. And you see everybody going, oh. One of them. Instead of saying, hey man, cool, you've got a nice new car, that's wonderful. Yeah? You know, but there's a lot of times I've seen this feeling of, oh, there he goes again. You know. Trouble is that people don't realize when you buy a new car, you end up with more problems if you buy a decent second-hand one. When you love your neighbor as yourself, you will honor your father and your mother. You won't think about killing anybody. You won't think about committing adultery. You won't think about stealing. You won't think about lying and bearing false witness against them. And you certainly won't go lusting after your neighbor's stuff, because you'll have plenty for yourself. We've got to teach this. They'll be trained. The third goal is health, good health. They'll be trained in health. Health doesn't just happen. Health doesn't just happen. It's going to be made to happen. Mr. Armstrong, in his autobiography, mentions, he said, I learned from leading physicians, he says, that is the very few who have studied foods or the cause of sickness and disease. They estimate variously between 85 and 95% of all sickness and disease, which is not of mental origin, is caused by faulty diet. And the small remaining percentage from other causes combined. They will have to be taught how to grow things. I know this sounds so basic, but it's so wrong today. You start with the soil. That's where we came from, after all. Everything we eat comes out of it one way or the other. They'll have to be taught how to get the soil right. Because if you've got all the microbes and all that, soil's a living thing. If you get soil, proper soil, under a microscope, there's a whole army going on in there. And these bugs and things all in there all help the plant absorb the minerals and stuff from the actual soil. In recent years, a growing number of reports have appeared which concluded that some of today's foods are not as nutritious as those eaten in the past. It's a report in the Journal of Complementary Medicine in 2001 pointed out that the US and UK government statistics show a decline in trace minerals of up to 76% in fruit and vegetables over the period 1940 to 1991. That's basically my lifetime, short of a couple of years. In 2003, we've got Canada. I've got to put a bit of Canada here. I've got to keep Mr. Pippi happy, yeah? 2003, News Canada reported that today's fruit and vegetables contain far fewer nutrients than they did 50 years ago. They claimed that potatoes, tomatoes, bananas, and apples were notably less nutritious. For example, the study found that potatoes had lost 100% of all the vitamin A. None. Modern potatoes do not contain it. 57% of vitamin C and iron, and 28% of their calcium. The report went on to examine data from the US Department of Agriculture involving vegetable quality, which showed that over the entire 20th century, the average mineral content of such vegetables as cabbage, lettuce, sorry children, spinach, and tomatoes declined from 400 milligrams to less than 50. Milligrams. Those of us have been trying to, you know, supplement things by getting fresh fruit, fresh vegetables, and juicing them, but then you're getting a lot more than you can physically eat. Just try and get some of this, what's left in the food, into the body. If you remember, we had those videos over the last few years Mr. Bowles put on, showing how the cells reproduce, and all the things that one cell needs to produce, and we're not giving them. They're not getting it, and then what happens? Well, they mutate. Oh, but you know, if you're an evolutionist, that's great, because if they mutate, we're getting better, aren't we? No, we're not. We're getting full of cancers. Milk. Staple diet for a lot of people. So many people can't take milk anymore. Why? Well, simply this, because God made cows to eat grass, not cement, high protein, ground up sheep, fish. Yeah, that's what they feed them today. High protein pellets. They never see grass in most of the cows now, and in many parts of the world. They're in feedlots, and they get sick, so they pump them full of antibiotics. Milk, just the milk that comes from these cows, right? The iron content has fallen 62%. Now, iron's very important. Very important. Magnesium was down 21%. The copper content had totally disappeared. Because it's not in the grass. Because the grass is being artificially fertilized. Turkey meat, 4%. It's 4% of the nutritional value in a lot of turkey meat. This is gone. Parmesan cheese was the worst affected, recording a 70% fall. Parmesan cheese, you think cheese, oh, powerful stuff. No. And here's one for all you steak lovers. This is, you can use this, guys, and ladies who like your steak. You can use this for the argument that the 8-ounce steak is out, you've got to have a 16-ounce steak, you see? Because the iron content of beef rump steak has dropped by 55%. 55%. Even that lovely, succulent, juicy rump steak. And then we have all the allergies, don't we? Because we've mistreated the cows. You muck about with nature and it bites you. Seriously. I went over some of this the other day, but for the benefit of ingraining it, our food is not grown today to make us healthy. Our food is grown today for the profit of the major companies. They feed the crops, is fed on chemical fertilizer. They spray it with herbicides to kill the weeds. They spray it with insecticides to kill the bugs. Fresh vegetables, they wash in chlorine, which is a deadly poison. They put them in a bag, they fill it full of nitrogen to make sure it doesn't rot anymore. And then to make sure they put it under radioactive isotopes which totally kills every living organism in your lettuce, carrot, or apple, or whatever. So all the enzymes and the things that you should have been getting that your body needs is dead. But hey, tomatoes for us, and tomatoes for you a lot over in the colonies, they can now last for 4 weeks on the shelf and still be firm and juicy. Like I said, you get more nutrition eating the packaging. And then, of course, you've got the disaster with GM food. I can go on that for hours. Basically, what they're doing is they're making the plant produce an insecticide so that when the bug comes along and eats the plant, it dies. Now, I'm sure that if you then have something on that plant, like a corn on the cob type job, corn, and the Americans call it, surely the stuff's going in there as well? Or am I being naive? I think not. It's all done for profit. These people are going to be taught God has a 7-year cycle. God has a 50-year cycle. Now, most of us would say, well, 50 years isn't once in a lifetime. We've just celebrated with 3 families here. We got together and had lunch yesterday. Because it was all exactly 50 years ago when we met our wives. Right? And I said, well, we'll do this again in 50 years' time because we'll still be around. They're going to learn the 7-year cycle. They're going to learn crop rotation. They're going to learn the value of letting the land lie fallow for a year. Mental health. Oh boy. We live in a make-believe world. We have movies, right? Now, in the good old bad old days, you had Roy Rogers and the Lone Ranger. Yeah. And the old Indians would come over the hill there and they'd be bang, 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 and all these guys are falling. I don't know how they all do it so cool, but they all fall off the horse. And they're obviously all going to get up after the film is over, right? But it looks pretty good. No blood, nothing. Just bang, you fall over. Then we got to the A-team. Remember the A-team? They're the guys that sorted out all the problems of the world with a cigar hanging out of his mouth. But again, you know, it was kind of clean. You know, a guy got shot and he fell over. Just blew. I've seen people shot and I've seen them fall over. And believe me, they don't just fall over. It's not pleasant. It's vile. It's horrible. But that's what they're doing now, you see, because they got people to that stage. Now, when the machine gun goes across somebody's chest, you've got to see the bullets going through and a little bit of blood coming out, yeah? And the next film, the splattering's on the wall behind the guy, you see? That makes it even more realistic. And then he doesn't just die, he goes on the floor, he writhes around a bit. It's got to be more realistic. Why? Because they've got to keep the audience interested. And so it goes on and on and on. I don't know what the latest... I haven't seen a movie since... I can't remember when. I wouldn't want to go to watch any of them anyway. But they get more... You have Jaws. Think of Jaws. I remember the first Jaws that came out. I think it was a shark or something was eating people or whatever. Boom, 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 music and all the rest of it. But then you had Jaws 2. Now that's got to be more bloody to attract people in. That's what people want to see. And this is the kind of mess we are living in to where our children get on video games and they are the person firing the gun and killing people. And you wonder how we got mental problems? You watch these EastEnders, these soap operas so-called, and all they are is a microcosm of society. Because something happens on there and the next day people are doing. Divorce, running off with the girl next door, and I won't even go into it. It was as degrading as you can get. It's all on there, I believe, live. And it's affecting people. And people are under pressure. If they get a bit of money, they're worried about losing it. And they're worried about their job because of all the problems in the labor market. People are just worry. Biggest selling drugs in America and Britain are tranquilizers. But you know, with God's spirit, you know, it's second... Timothy 1:7, God has not given us a spirit of fear. He's given us a sound mind. And that's what we're going to have to teach them. They will have to be trained to develop drive. You know, we've met people and, you know, there's that proverb, I think I'm just quoting it off the top of my head, I can't go outside. There's a lion outside. I'm going to stay here in bed. It's safe. It's nice. And then tomorrow maybe I'll have another think about it. Maybe. They can no drive. We need drive. These people are going to be told, yes, you've got 7 months of clearing all this mess up, but keep thinking beyond. Keep thinking beyond. You've got to keep going. But it's going to get better as you go along. It's going to get better by leaps and bounds. And the harder you work, the quicker the job gets done. And they'll be focusing on the future. They'll be told, you've got to work your salvation out. If you want to be in a God family, you've got to prove to us that you want it. You want it more than anything else. Just as we've got to prove that today. They'll have to be taught resourcefulness. They're going to have all sorts of problems. The landscape is going to be covered with unexploded bombs, shells, bullets, hand grenades. These all have to be gathered up, collected, got rid of somehow. Whether it be just buried in a hole or what all. But they're going to have to use... We're not going to do the work. We're going to guide them. We're going to lead them. And when they come short, then we'll help them. We all know the story about Zechariah, but the flesh coming off the bodies and all that. I suppose that's a good form of fertilizer, isn't it? I don't know. They're not going to cut down the... In Ezekiel 39, it talks about... They all need to cut down the trees. For 7 years, they're banned from cutting down trees. They've got to live off what's been left by this army. Everyone will help clearing up the land. Think about it. It's going to be fabulous, especially as we get towards the end of that 7 months. The 7 months, and we're getting towards the, hey, we've got the last truckload going out from this area. And then we can get rid of the trucks because they're dirty, filthy, smelly things anyway. But they've just done a job. In verse 13 of Ezekiel 39, it says, everyone in Israel will help, for it will be a glorious victory for Israel when I demonstrate my glory on that day, says the Sovereign Lord. In other words, he created the mess, he brought the people back, and he's helped them to clean it all up. And he says, this way you'll know that I am the God. I am the God that's done all this. Living on supplies left from the army, I was just thinking, you know, they'll probably live in things like tents for years. I mean, if the weather is organized, and the one sowing seed is going to be chasing the guy harvesting the previous crop, it gives you the idea that the seasons are going to be quite benign. The Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve were running around with no clothes on. They must have been quite comfortable. So, you know, the weather's going to be quite reasonable. Because there is a principle. If you turn to Proverbs 24, verse 27, this is a principle you can teach them. Now, I've seen people break this, and it broke them. You can read it in the modern translation. It says, do your planning and prepare your fields before building your house. Right? Is that not basic sense? Can you eat a house? Not unless it's made of chocolate. You've got to get the crops in first. You've got to get the land right first. So that's not important. You can live in tents for years. It could well be that the land is still going to be moving around a little bit for a while until it settles down. If you think continents have been moved, we know it's going to happen in Jerusalem. There's a whole section of land there. It's about 40 odd miles long and about 15 miles or so wide. It's going to be raised up. And the temple's going to be on top of that. And you will go up to Jerusalem. It's measured out in the Bible. You can get the names of the places and you can work out the size of the place. That's a lot of things. Mount of Olives, I've been there, I walked on it. It's pretty reasonable size. Split that in two, that's going to cause an awful lot of shaking. So maybe it won't be a good idea to build anything solid for a few years until the land has finally sort of settled down. But resourcefulness is going to be very, very important. And then perseverance. They're going to have to be taught, as Mr. Ram called it, stick-to-itiveness. They're going to have to really stick to the job. I think I've told some of you before, but for those who haven't heard it, when we first got to college, we were all in an assembly, and Mr. McNair was giving us a little bit of the old work ethic speech. Because, you know, all the students had a job. Some were janitors that looked after buildings, some in the gardens and so on. And if for some reason he picked on one of the janitor's job. Mr. McNair, by the way, bless him, he could not tell the joke. He never ever got the punchline and the joke together. He'd get one or the other separate. But he came up with this and he just said, you know, it doesn't matter what you're doing. If you, whatever you're doing, throw yourself into it. If you're cleaning the toilet. And 400 students collapsed in a pile. But seriously, you've got to stick to it, because when, you know, there's the old, you know, when the going gets tough, the tough get going type thing. You've got to hang in there, because the end, we will get there. Although if the feast and the preparation for the feast is anything like the millennium, then I can see us in the last 50 years running around this earth like a bunch of scalded cats and headless chickens, getting everything finished. It's always a rush, isn't it? We always just seem to make it, though. But people will need, they will need to have this instilled in them. And whenever they meet a problem, and you see, this is a problem we're going to have, and this is what Mr. Armstrong was saying, in those first two or three generations, whenever they come up a problem, initially, what are they going to go to for answers? They're going to look back into their old life in the old world, aren't they? There's your problem, you see. Because that's all they've known before. And that's what we've got to change. That's what we've got to change. You've got to change the whole way people think. You're not going to do that overnight. They'll be taught to put the right value on such basic things as water. You know, in most countries, I saw a film the other night, I turned the television on for a few minutes, and there was a thing on the River Ganges in India, and along the side of the bank, they're burning all the bodies, and then when the bodies are half burned or thereabouts, they slide them into the river, because they do that, and then they're off onto the next stage when they become a mosquito or an ant or whatever. Yeah, we can laugh, but that's what these millions and millions and millions of people believe this. Yeah, and 50 yards down, there's people there bathing in the river and taking buckets of water out. I don't know if they drink or cook or what they do with it. But, I mean, that water, the level of gunge in this river was 1,200 times as high as we would regard as being dangerous in the West. And this is a holy river. And China's the same. China's just the same. We've ruined the water. In other countries, we've murdered the water. I mean, in America, you've got the Colorado River. It does not reach the sea. It hasn't reached the sea for quite a number of years. It's been pumped dry. Down in South Africa, there's one of the rivers that do that. It's a big, big river. And as it gets down towards the sea, it goes through a desert area, and eventually it just disappears. Never makes it to the sea. The water just sinks down away. Gone. And the Hoover Dam, I believe they're now hacking another hole in it so they can draw more water off from the lower dam. And when that's gone, and it's not very much, it's not much further down, the turbines, I believe, will be exposed, and the Hoover Dam will shut down. No more electricity, no more water. I read this morning, I got a news thing in, saying that the northern part of California, they've discovered new fault lines where there's been no slippage. You know, they're measuring 1,200 miles now in California. They've got sensors all along the different fault lines, and they measure the slippage. Because most fault lines do slip, and that's great, because they're just slipping a little bit, a little bit, a little bit. It relieves the tension, right? But there's 200 or 300 miles where there's been no slippage, as far as they can ascertain, for the last several hundred years. And guess where that area is? It's in Northern California. It's in Northern California, where all these rivers and the waters and the reservoirs and the canals and everything, they're all vulnerable. If there is a massive earthquake up in that area, the water supply to the bulk of California will be cut. Not damaged, cut, finished, kaput. Think about it. How many people live in California? I remember seeing figures not a few years back where they said if California was a nation instead of just a state, it would be the 12th biggest country on earth. That's just California. They are the breadbasket of America. because they water the desert, and the desert blossoms like a rose. But it's all on water. And guess what they've just done? Some wonderful guy has just dumped massive amount of water into one of the waterways, and it's the stuff they've been used for fracking. So that whole area is now gone. They can't use it. See, we're not looking after it. Water is the most fundamental. The soil and the water is fundamental to life, isn't it? That's why we use it as a type of God's Holy Spirit. In the millennium, what does God do? Rivers coming out the mountains, springs, ponds, fountains, loaded with fish. Why? Because that's the basic foodstuff that will, in the millennium, everywhere you go there's fish. And it says masses of fish. I've been down to the Dead Sea. There's no fish in there. If you put a fish in there, it'd be rock solid in 5 minutes. You can't even sink in the thing. It's so thick. Water's so gooey. The salt. But there's going to be fish there. All but the one end. The one end will be a salt reef bed. So that I would take it that there'll be saltwater fish in there. But there'll be fish in there. Lots of fish. So fish looks like being a very important part of the diet. You know, try buying fish today. In England, it used to be cheap, cheap, cheap. No? Yeah, I saw cod fillet the other day was the same price as rump steak. And I believe over in America, well, I've been over there a few times to various places, and I never see fish. I don't know if you all eat fish over there. Fish is a vital part of a diet. And we come to the last law of success, and that is a relationship with God. Now, we have that today. If we go to God for our healing, we go to God to talk over all our problems. We get results time after time after time. We get results. But these people, we're going to be dealing with them face to face. And when they can't sort something out, turn to Isaiah 41. We will do the things for them that they can't do. Isaiah 41 verse 17. When the poor and needy seek water and there is none. There's a lot of places in the world where there isn't any water. It's just bone dry. And their tongue fails for thirst. I, the Eternal, will hear them. And the God of Israel, and as far as I remember, that's Elohim, will not forsake them. I will open rivers in the high... I will open rivers. Create them in the high places. And fountains in the midst of the valleys. I will make the wilderness a pool of water. And the dry land springs of water. Why? Because I need to do that if I'm going to plant trees. I will plant in the wilderness the cedar, the acacia tree, the myrtle and the oil tree. I will set in the desert the fir tree, the pine tree and the box tree. You know, trees are vital. Absolutely vital. They're part of the world's air conditioning system. They cool things down. They change the weather. They modify the weather. They stabilize the rain situation. Timber, I mean, is useful for, well, hey, look at it, holding the building up, put it in the fire, do your barbecue with it. Amazing stuff. But the thing is, why does God do this? In verse 20 of Isaiah 41, this is why God does it. That they may see and know and consider and understand together that the hand of the Eternal has done this, and the Holy One of Israel has created it. You see, it's focusing mankind now on God as a creator, which is what God wanted them to be in the first place. When Christ was in the Garden of Eden, he wanted to be with the people. He wanted to be with Abraham. He wanted to be with Joshua. He must have been with Abraham a lot because he was a friend. You don't build a friendship up in 5 minutes. Yeah. And what does he want at the end? The holy city comes down. We'll see that in a minute. That's what God wants. But he's doing things and that people can see. You know, we're told, how do we look at people? You know, if you want to look at somebody and you're thinking about, but it says, by their fruits. By their fruits, you will know them. What are they doing? How are they living? And you can see that they're going the right direction or they're not going the right direction or what. This is God doing the same thing. He's saying, look at my works. I've planted these trees. I've made this. I've done that. Why? So you can have a perfect world to live in. Now you go address it and keep it. We're then going to build on it. We get to do, I'm just thinking about that, we get to almost do what the angels should have done. We get to finish the earth off. Because after the great commotion, shall we call it, the earth settles down, it's going to be, there's going to be a lot of tohu and bohu about. And not a lot of people. And it's going to have to be literally remodeled. So in other words, I'm just thinking about that, you know, maybe you should go on that road. We're actually going to be, well, we're going to be guiding the people to finish off the earth, to make it back to what it should have been in the garden in Eden. You know, God's still got the original plans. The garden of Eden, the animals were tame. Yeah? Otherwise the lion would come up to Adam and Adam would say, I'm going to call you a lion. And the lion would say, ha ha, you're my lunch. And that would have been the end of the story right there, wouldn't it? So you see, we're going back to what it was. Rivers, pools, water, springs, all precious and needing treating properly, needing looking after, needing dressing, needing keeping. Because otherwise, lose that. That's your life. And our attitude towards these people. You know, Psalm 103 gives us some idea. This is God's attitude towards us. This has got to be our attitude towards the people that we are going to be teaching and training. Like a father pities his children, so the Lord pities them that fear him. For he knows our frame. He remembers that we are dust. Or in a modern translation, the Lord eternal is like a father to his children, tender and compassionate to those that fear him. For he knows how weak we are. He remembers we're only dust. Can you think what it's going to be like for somebody who's going through a real drama, and a member of the God family puts an arm around them and says, come on, buddy, I'll show you how to do it. Can you think how they're going to feel? We will always be there to help and to guide, because they will have the Holy Spirit. They will be teachable, and we will be teachers. They will be used to the God family always being there, but they will be doing the work. And then you've got the examples in the New Testament where, what would we be like? Well, Christ appeared in the room, didn't he? He still had the scars on his hands. He still had the hole in his body where the spear had gone in. And he made Thomas stick his fist right up inside it and said, now you believe. So he was solid. He sat down with them and he ate food. He walked with the other disciples along the road that time, and he blanked their mind out, so they didn't know who he was until he asked the blessing on the food, and then he disappeared. We're going to be like that. That's what we're going to be like. And he appears. We will be like him. We will be the teachers that it talks about in Isaiah 30. Now, I don't want to end on a downer at one level, but I saw this quote by Mr. Armstrong, and I just want to read it. Because it is a warning to us. It is a serious warning to us. I think we're on the right track. I think we're holding on to what we were taught through Jesus, from Jesus Christ, and through Mr. Armstrong. But listen to what Mr. Armstrong said. This is in 1985, less than a year before he died. To the church, and not anyone but the church, Jesus said, if you overcome, I will grant you to sit with me on my throne and help me rule the world and teach the world. Jesus is the teacher and Jesus is the ruler. And he quotes Revelation 5:10 saying, we will be kings and priests and we will rule on the earth. Capital letters, bold, underlined, exclamation mark. And sad bit, he says, brethren, I don't think you'll ever learn that. Think about it. And that was to people at Headquarters Church. Has my teaching been in vain, brethren? Sometimes I wonder. I get terribly discouraged. I don't think you get it. Again, bold, underlined. I think too much Protestantism has rubbed off on you, and you just don't understand the truth when I give it to you. And it is really Christ giving it to you through me, and I'm certainly not competent to give it to you myself. That's where we get the material that we are hanging on to. That's the way we got the material that if we don't hang on to it, someone else will take our crown. Because that's the material you have to get the crown. Is that complicated? Oh, I wish people outside in the greater church would understand this. There is only one source of truth, and that source is Jesus Christ. And he selected that one man, and through him, he set all the, shall we call them, rules and regulations, the traditions in the church. He revealed the holidays, the plan of God, and we've got that. We sit here now with all this tremendous fund of knowledge, and so many people have spurned it. Or they're building on that knowledge, but not on the foundation. They're building an outhouse in the middle of the field. It's not attached to the temple that we heard about the other day. We've got to be on that temple, on that foundation, nowhere else. Now, here's the good news. If we hold fast to what we were taught in the first place, right, we can say with the same confidence as did the Apostle Paul in 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 8. Please turn to it. Let's read it and let's see how Paul saw this. Oh, mind you, we can't because he was wrong, wasn't he? He was 2,000 years wrong, people. How can we accept the word of Paul? That's one of the arguments they use because Mr. Armstrong was always saying, it's going to be soon, it's going to be soon. And we're here sitting today, I'm telling you straight, it's going to be soon. Very soon. If we're hanging on to that gospel that was once and for all delivered to the saints, and we're holding fast, we can still say then exactly what Paul says here. Henceforth, there is laid up for me a crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, shall give me at that day. And not me only, but unto all of them also that love his appearing. Then the real job begins, people.